I'm Dan.
And I'm Alex, and welcome back to On Air. Pleased to be back with you guys on another Wednesday. It's the 22nd of April. Dan is joining us. It's morning where he is. It's evening where I am. How are you?
I am good. It feels good to be back after a very crazy last week for the both of us, travel-wise, yeah. I think. How are you feeling?
Yeah, quite busy. It was busy, wasn't it? And also, we've, again, been having to keep up with the complexities of time zones, travel, and also the way that aviation right now is not functioning anywhere near normal for a variety of reasons that, of course, we'll go into. So thank you guys, listeners, for bearing with us last week, as we had no choice but to skip the week. We did try. It is always the last resort. But hopefully, if you guys have ever wondered, if you perhaps opened your podcast feeds and noticed the episode wasn't there, that we would always announce something like that on the shared Instagram. So the shared Instagram at On Air with Dan and Alex, all one word. It was posted there last Wednesday.
Precisely.
But all is fine, however. How have you been?
Alex, I've been exhausted. I flew 5 flights, 29 hours in the span of like 5 or 6 days. And when you're on a flight every single day, there was one day where I was just like, what am I doing? My body was starting to be like, no, this is not a good idea. But now I've gotten some time to recover, and I've started, you know, as we mature with every year we've had this podcast 3 years now, you learn more thing, like more ways to help yourself recover. And one of those is, after doing something very exhausting, I'm always like, okay, let's up the class of hotel we're at a little bit in order to, we can afford that investment in our recovery.
So you are basically trying to spin the fact that you're in your choosing even higher grade hotel era, all in the name of recovery, of course, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's important, you know.
Okay, not doing anything for the lack of man of the people rumors, let me tell you. people will relate to the fact that there is nothing quite like, I mean, actually, that's always a funny social media trend, which is, you know, when you're planning a friend's trip, and there are the friends that say, well, it doesn't matter where we stay because we're not going to be in the room anyway. And then, like, there's the other friend who it really matters. Yeah. And
well,
I wonder which one you are.
I'm with two friends like that right now. We're on a friends trip with some of my friends from my childhood. And it's literally, they're staying in a shared dorm hostel.
Okay.
Which, you know, maybe is not my preferred place to stay, so we've
accepted
that we will be staying in different places on this trip, and that is fine because we each need to protect our mental health.
So for the sake of you being able to enjoy the trip, what is it? They go back to their hostel and they're content with it, and you go back to the Four Seasons, and this is where we are.
Well, let's say it's something along those lines.
That's so funny. How did they feel about this when you first came to this conclusion? Was there something that happened that triggered this? Did you just settle for their choice once before?
With each trip we've done before, every few years, it's actually been like a slight elevation of standards each time. The previous trip we were on a couple of years ago, I ended up paying for all our hotels. Just they paid like however much they wanted to pay per night, which I guess was like 10 euros a night per person for their would-be hostel. And I paid the difference to get a nice hotel, which wasn't, I mean, then we were at, you know, a Courtyard by Marriott's and that kind of stuff. Now I'm like, this needs to end. I can't keep, we're, you know, reaching an age where I can't keep paying for your guys' hotels. Let's settle on doing things separately this time.
Bloody hell. Never have I benefited from the likes of you from a hotel stay. Yeah, who are these friends that you're paying for holiday? Is it because you're the resident YouTuber of the friends group? Is that why?
Yes, and it's because I know that if I go somewhere with you, you want to stay in the same type of hotel I want to stay in. It's not like with them.
Yeah, but I don't want to pay either. Nobody does. So if
those
you're
days
willing
are
to
over. He should have gone on a trip with me in 2024. I might have.
Listen. Wait, there is a link.
Hold on. Last year when we were in Singapore, I did heavily subsidize your hotel with my points.
Absolutely. Sorry. Absolute rubbish. You paid by points and I gave you the equivalent in cash.
Oh, absolutely. But the cash price of that stay was like double what we paid thanks to me using my points.
So, sorry. I gave you the equivalent of points in cash. Whether or not the hotel that night decided to elevate the price. So what? So it's not enough, is it? We've got to go by dynamic pricing as well. Even with our friendship, I've got to go, Dan, I'll send you the money. I am not being in debt to you for you to bring it up 1 year later. Goodness me.
No. It's not at all like that. I'm just saying that I do, you know, try to support my friends in need.
I never asked for you to support me. Thank you so much. Okay. Actually, let's just rewind. Let's take it all the way back a decade ago when we met. Okay. We land. So Dan and I had just met for the first time at the Lufthansa A320neo delivery. We land. It's late at night. It's cold and winter and dark and horrible. And we're in Frankfurt of all places. And while we're kind of like saying goodbyes, this resident YouTuber has absolutely nowhere to stay that night. I'm looking at him like, right. He's like, yeah. So he's like, he sits down at a random gate and he pulls open his laptop and he's like scrolling booking.com and Marriott. And I was like, poor guy. So I said to him, Dan, I mean, if it helps, my sister works for Marriott, if you would like that. Well, of course. I mean, his eyes lit up, money bags in his eyes. He saw a discount heading his way. I said, well, I can speak to my sister. I think she can get you a competitive rate as a Marriott associate. And he was like, oh, that would be great. So remember, I've known the guy 5 minutes. So I graciously book him a heavily subsidized, discounted Marriott group fare for a night stay to ensure that he has, you know, a pillow to put his head down on at night. And he has the audacity 10 years later to somehow imply that what I was paying equivalent to points wasn't quite enough for our stay in Singapore last year.
I really do appreciate that. And that was the first favor of many you did back then, which I, of course, I'm grateful for and I recognize, because I might have been in a suit at this event, but I had like a monthly income of $300. So I wasn't about to fly to Stockholm and pay. I mean, I would have probably ended up in a shared bed hostel back then, which I remember I was invited to go on TV. And the night before, I stayed in a 20-room hostel because that was all I could afford back then. So, you know,
and look, this is good. This is the story. Genuinely speaking, this is the story of your growth, right? This is the growth journey. It's so easy for people to think that someone as visible as you, because they can, you've only got to go onto YouTube and to see you in a beautiful hotel, in a video that you just posted, or in a first class somewhere, and people think, oh, it's always been like that for him. And you know that's not the case. And we've also spoken about
that. You know that's not the case.
Yeah, okay, I know, you're right. But maybe the public do think that is the case. But bless you, it's not. You're a grafter and you've worked hard to accomplish what you have. And also, I'm remembering that night in Frankfurt. Did we then try and get me into the Air Canada lounge on a BA ticket as a kind
of return
of the favor? And they were like, no, you're in the wrong terminal.
And not to mention the fact that you had a check-in bag as your carry-on, which made everything all the more exciting.
Oh, memories. Yeah, anyway, memories. A simpler time in aviation, that's for sure, because where we are now, it is not. Yeah. The situation across the Middle East still having that global impact being felt in fares, the fluctuating, mostly rising oil price, the price of jet fuel, which has skyrocketed and continues to do so no matter how much the President of the United States tries to manipulate markets with his pre-market tweets and his post-market outbursts and so on. With the Gulf carriers losing a big market of travelers because people are avoiding the Gulf, and also they're bookings were cancelled. They know that there's a period of uncertainty right now. The conflict is still with a question mark. There is a ceasefire at the moment, but it's very unclear as to what the pathway is forward in terms of if there will be some kind of settlement, if they will achieve peace, in inverted commas, if it's going to go back to escalations. It's very unclear, and understandably, people are avoiding the Gulf carrier, so the loads are lighter. However, you and I have both flown Gulf carriers quite a bit over the last 10 days.
Yes. Well, I mean, quite a bit is maybe an exaggeration, but we have flown them. And I have to say, I think it was fascinating. I'm debating whether or not to, you know, make a whole video about it. But basically, the lesson is that my flights, at least, were not at all empty. I mean, we talk about people avoiding those airlines for now, but my flight, I flew through Abu Dhabi, and the second flight was Abu Dhabi to Paris. That flight was completely sold out. The only cabin that had any empty seats were first, where there were just a few empty seats. So, you know, there's definitely a reduction in demand due to the reduction in capacity among these airlines. But
yeah,
things are very normal. And I just find it so fascinating, because if we had spoken about this 2 weeks ago, I'd be like, what? Flying through the Gulf like that? That feels a bit risky. Do you want to do that right now when everything is so uncertain? But then I got on these flights and I'm like, there are hundreds of people here who clearly have got to the same conclusion as I have, that this is, you know, the equation works out in favor of doing this today, and they all ended up there. I don't know what was your thinking.
Yeah, I mean, so it's obviously out of necessity as well, and different people are flying for different reasons. But I would say that the main kind of things that I had noted down in differences, the demographic of passengers is different. There are far fewer passengers who seem as if they're traveling for leisure, and actually it seems majority work travel, not even really like work traveling to a conference or work traveling to a perhaps another city office, but actually the movement of laborers and construction workers and those who are working in the building industry and so on. Most of my flights had a transit flow that had that as the predominant demographic of traveler. The lack of the kind of like, let's do an early summer in Europe traveler was very evident, because that would be the case now that we're in late April, especially the Gulf carriers that are responsible for bringing up Aussies and those from Southeast Asia up into Europe, particularly those who like to have that holiday now rather than when it gets too busy in June, July, August. So that was a kind of something that was the same. Something that was different, rather. In terms of everything else, everything was very, I mean, the element of the onboard service, everything as it was before, everything perfect and lovely and fine there. Of course, chatting with the crew, many of them had barely flown. For my first set of flights, the crew, it was for all of them, it was their first flight since February 28th. Because, of course, these airlines, the Gulf carriers, have thousands and thousands of crew, and their flight schedules have reduced so much that now it's taking a while until it comes around to be their turn to fly. So, but the crew were quite optimistic. There is also this resilience that is inbuilt, I think, in people that live or are based in the Middle East, and they know that the Middle East states, particularly the Gulf states, are very good at keeping their population, their residents safe. And that's why there is this sentiment about how, you know, oh, it is still safer despite XYZ. And that definitely has resonated. Even a lot of the crew that I'd spoken to were very keen to say just how safe they felt, even when they could hear interceptions or they could feel the vibrations of it. And understandably, that's scary, especially when you're retelling the story. But that they didn't feel that worried because they know that the governments have them protected there. So good that they felt that sense of security. Interestingly, something they all had in common on all flights is they said that the bulk of the crisis, particularly while airspace was closed, is the most well-rested they yeah. had ever they had ever been, because they had been waking up in the morning when you're supposed to, going to sleep in the evening when you're supposed to, sleeping through the night. One of them said to me, she said, I've never been to the gym so much in my life, and it's got me back into a good gym routine. And and this is of course because the golf carriers, as you know, Dan, are banked in their schedules, where the waves of departure and arrivals extend right through a 24-hour period. It's perfectly normal to arrive for a flight that departs at 2 o'clock in the morning, flights that depart at 4 a.m. and so on. So those that work on golf carriers, particularly pilots and crew, are very used to that 24-hour operation, and particularly most of them end up just working constantly nights because of the way things are structured, rather than waking up and flying at a sociable hour at 8 a.m., for example. Yeah. So nice to hear that they felt rested, and I think for that reason as well, they were in better spirits. Did you notice similar?
I mean, absolutely. The crew were the happiest and friendliest I've literally almost ever had. It was so fun to see that change. But I think maybe there is, you know, a slightly different demographic on our respective flights, just because the UAE has been open for longer to traffic. Because me looking at the other passengers, it was very much the vibe that these are all people who had just either one booked flights before everything started, and there's no suitable option to rebook on at a reasonable price, which there really isn't. So they're going ahead with their original plan. Or B, there seemed to be a lot of people who found some pretty good deals on flights and said, okay, I'm willing to, you know, accept this maybe slight risk of, I guess the main risk might be disruption, but I'm willing to accept some risk, so I'll just take this good deal and fly it anyway. Those were sort of the main groups, and obviously people who live in the UAE flying to or from there.
And of course, the UAE has more point-to-point traffic because of the sheer volume of people that live there and so on and so on, and then their relatives. So you're right, there would have been different experiences there. We're hoping that, you know, there is some form of stability on the horizon, particularly for the golf carriers, who are now going to have to start strategizing on the return in a significant way to hold on to or to restore that market share that they had, and that Singapore Airlines and Cathay Pacific have been able to eat up during this crisis, because everyone was pivoting to alternative carriers as the world moved away from the Middle East because of the way that conflict had broken out. So it's they've got a long road ahead, that's for sure. And Turkish Airlines benefiting as well. There are small developments that you can see if you understand the state of play. For example, Australians are now visa exempt to go to, from, but crucially to transit via Turkey. Now, this is so significant, and it's incredibly timely, because it has just become much easier for an Australian passenger to choose Turkish Airlines, which of course have recently set up shop in Australia, to transit via Istanbul. Don't have to worry about the transit visa, and it's now visa-free to Turkish Airlines, hundreds and hundreds of destinations. None of this is coincidental. This is literally because these competitors, Turkish, Cathay, Singapore, are able to increase their market share, knowing that when Ralph sits down to consider who he's going to fly with for an airline, and it's him, and perhaps it's a family trip, maybe he has young children, he's looking for certainty. And at the moment, those carriers are able to provide him with that certainty until there is some form of definitive end to this current conflict. Because aviation is incredibly resilient. And also, we've spoken about this before, haven't we, about how people just forget. I mean, if this ends, people forget very, very quickly as to what they've just seen.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah. So that, yeah, I mean, I agree. This is an interesting time because, as you say, airlines are benefiting, but it's also a time of incredible struggle for airlines with the fuel prices mounting. And that's what we want to dive into today again, because obviously the Strait of Hormuz is still not open. And just for context here, Europe, one of the markets that relies the most on oil and jet fuel, specifically for the podcast from the Strait of Hormuz, we take 40% of our jet fuel from there. So currently, 40% of the supply is disrupted. And we've been talking I mean, since at least the beginning of April, about how the clock is ticking on how Europe can sustain this. And we're now, I think, since in the past week or so, we've seen more and more outlets start reporting that we are a few weeks away from major meltdown crisis in European aviation if that supply is not restored, right?
Absolutely. And this is already filtering out into fuel rationing across Italy, for example, where there are several Italian airports, Bologna, Milan, Venice, Brindisi, the smaller airports now capping and issuing fuel rationing policies to ensure that other airlines and the airlines that operate there are not emptying those airports of fuel. Airfares are on the whole up to around 10%, and this is a European story. It's sometimes a little more, a little less, depending on other markets. Fuel surcharges are on the up as well. It's pretty, I mean, we're seeing airlines take some pretty drastic measures. You will have seen the headline with Lufthansa that is everywhere today about the 20,000 flights that they're cancelling. So there isn't an airline that is immune or in a better position than others with this scenario. And Lufthansa has cancelled 20,000 flights between May and October to save fuel. And this is so far one of the largest announcements of cuts, at least covering a longer period for any airline as a result of this war on Iran. The 120 daily flights that are being removed from the system and therefore result into cancellations start Monday, and its routes from Munich and Frankfurt, and it extends right through the summer season all the way until mid-October. Lufthansa warning there may be more, but this is something that they have to do at the moment because their schedules that they had previously determined, outlined, established pre-February 28th are now no longer doable post-February 28th.
Yeah, it's interesting how in a lot of these things, Lufthansa always appears, you know, to act first because they're very quick to take action, often in ways that affect passengers negatively. And another sort of combination of the fuel crisis and the strikes we've seen at Lufthansa the past week is that they're also shutting down one of their many confusing subsidiaries, Lufthansa CityLine, an airline that has been so frequently joked about on this podcast, is now no longer with us, effective immediately. This primarily CRJ-900-based airline was removed from operations.
Removed from office.
Exactly. Yeah, literally. In favor of the new subsidiary, Lufthansa City Airline. Which, I mean, they just love their subsidiaries, don't you? But this was a combination.
Subsidiary or subsidiary? Isn't it subsidiary?
I thought it was subsidiary. Let's see.
I've always said a subsidiary. It's a subsidiary. It's a subsidiary of Lufthansa Group.
Good question, because it's spelled like, wait, everyone, you're going to get to hear this.
Okay.
Subsidiary, says Google. So
it's a subsidiary of. Subsidiary. Maybe I just say it too fast.
Maybe it's a British subsidiary. Thing. Yeah.
It's a subsidiary of the Lufthansa Group. Anyway, okay, it's a subsidiary. Now I'm thinking subsidiary. It's a goodness. Why am I doubting that? This is a
like
word I've used. Yeah, subsidiary.
Yeah.
So they've replaced it with City Airline, right? Because what they've been able to do here is now take out 27 older, less fuel efficient jets, right?
Yes. As we said, this is, I think this was also just a way for Carsten Spohr to scare and sort of take revenge on Lufthansa staff who were striking, which I think is, I mean, his labor relations policies are pretty egregious, for Europe, especially compared to all the other airlines and how infrequently they have strikes in comparison. But yeah, it's just a very drastic step to do something like this. And now we're seeing, as you say, 20,000 flights cut. I'm sure Gothenburg is definitely among those, with some traffic, interestingly, being moved to other Lufthansa Group Airlines, Swiss, Austrian, Brussels Airlines, which, you know, I think is an interesting tidbit there.
Virgin Atlantic CEO Cornel Costa told the FT that Virgin is going to struggle to turn a profit this year. I mean, okay, right?
Because, tell us something new.
Poor Virgin Atlantic don't need the Strait of Hormuz to be closed to struggle to turn a profit. But anyway, Virgin is not funny, but Virgin Atlantic will struggle to turn a profit this year, even after adding fuel surcharges, adding that no matter what happens in the Gulf going forward, this disruption to global energy prices will be here to stay. And as a result, Virgin Atlantic will not be profitable. I would say that maybe setting expectations for, but you know, perhaps the profit that they have been chasing is such a slim, thin kind of achievement, sadly, in Virgin Atlantic's endless quest for financial health, that of course something like this is able to knock that way off course. I mean, it's doing it for even the healthiest of airlines financially.
Yeah.
EasyJet is expecting similar kind of losses.
Yeah, if you think about it, Virgin Atlantic is kind of Delta Airlines' City Line. They are the lower cost subsidiary that, to be fair, they do things a lot better, in my opinion, than Delta. But they are just Delta's lower cost European equivalent, and anything they do that does not feed into Delta, unfortunately, does not make money, which, I mean, we both love Virgin Atlantic. I think they're one of the best airlines in Europe. So it pains me that they struggle so much. But without Delta, they're really in a bad spot.
There's so much we're racing. I mean, the time is really kind of passing us by, but there's so much that we want to get through because there has been a lot since we last spoke. So as I mentioned, that was the bit about kind of EasyJet and other airlines expecting those losses. Let's move on to, if we can, to this crazy non-story that came out in the middle of this crisis. So they're asking Donald Trump about what his plan is for a ceasefire. They're asking him about Iran. They're asking who he's talking to Iran. And is J.D. Vance going to Pakistan? He says live on air, no, he's not. And then J.D. Vance's office 2 minutes later says, yes, we are. And then the press secretary says, yes, he is. And then Trump doubled down with another publication and said, no, he's not. Chaos, right?
And then however, Melania in the comes middle out of this nowhere chaos, and goes, I'm not in the Epstein files.
What was that? Melania just unilaterally declaring in some kind of press conference while her husband is destroying the global economy and lives. She's coming out to distance herself from the Epstein files, which we know anyway. She's in because it's all available to read online. Anyway, anyway, in the middle of all this chaos, right? United CEO Scott Kirby, it is revealed, lobbied Donald Trump for a potential merger of United and American. This is something that he lobbied Trump in February, and the deal would have created, of course, the world's largest airline, with American and United taking control of over 40% of US capacity, becoming one airline. Immediately, what were your thoughts when you first heard this?
I mean, it's like an Onion article. It is so inconceivable that something like that would happen and be approved. Scott Kirby, United CEO, is an interesting figure because he worked at American Airlines previously, and his whole career seems to be about putting American Airlines down.
Yeah.
You know, attacking American Airlines. He has such a vendetta against them. Lord knows what happened while he was at American.
Bitterness, isn't there? That even the public, even those who are not involved in aviation, just know that the United CEO is constantly hitting and taking swipes at his former employer, American.
Precisely. There's been all this drama this spring in Chicago where United and American are sort of gearing up to fight a little bit for slot or for gate allocations. But now this just takes it to a whole nother level. And I think it's been interesting to hear American Airlines respond to it, because everyone knows, including American Airlines, that this type of merger would be terrible for the flying public. It would remove Oneworld largely from the US market besides Alaska Airlines, which is much smaller. And I just think that even under this administration, where businesses are lobbying as much as they can to get their mergers approved and this and that, this is one merger that is 99.99999% unlikely to be approved, because it would be just so catastrophic for the American consumer.
Of course, and the global air travel consumer who happens to fly on a US carrier. I mean, it's a disastrous idea, as you said, and it's absolutely not in the interest of consumers. American Airlines did shut this down in a statement last Friday, stating categorically that, quote, American Airlines is not engaged with or interested in any discussions regarding a merger with United Airlines. They also went on to say that it would be negative for competition, negative for consumers, and inconsistent with antitrust laws, even those under President Donald Trump. It's not anything that I think anyone that I had spoken to in my aviation, American aviation circles, had said that they thought was a good idea. Competition is very much required, and is, you know, it's not very common. Competition, the very idea of it, is just disappearing in the way that airlines are consolidating and are belonging to the same groups, and you think you're flying one, or perhaps I'll fly the other, and actually it's all going to the same pot, and therefore they're able to manipulate the pricing as a result to ensure that you still pay that high fare that you were avoiding. There was some government reaction from different senators like Elizabeth Warren and Mike Lee, and that's a bipartisan pairing there of those two, and they had written to both the CEOs of United and American along with their peers, demanding answers on the natures of any discussions. They did issue a deadline of the 3rd of May. I'm interested, and I will keep a track on what perhaps Scott Kirby is going to write in his justification to the Senate as to why he was floating this idea. But then again, I mean, you know, anyone who feels they could get away with anything now feels they have that chance with Trump in the White House. You know, it's just so easy for them now to say, oh, what about this? And we've seen, you can read the trusted reporting that has demonstrated this man's inability to follow the rules, play by the book, you know, not commit, for example, war crimes. It doesn't surprise me actually that
insider trading.
Yeah, the insider trading stuff. So this is actually pretty small. Of course, Scott Kirby thought, you know what, why don't we use Trump to our advantage? And this does remind me of when Trump had his more kind of low-key, by the grand scheme of things, more low-key first term, where the US carriers decided to unite as one and march into that White House because a level-headed administration was no longer there, and they marched into the White House and pointed at the Middle East and said, those guys are taking all our travelers. You need to do something to sanction the Gulf carriers because they're taking all our passengers, and we can't be financially healthy as a result. What they didn't realize is that Trump had relationships already with those in the Gulf and the Middle East, and actually he favored those because they had their, you know, admittedly, he's thinking about money, and he's thinking about who's richer in that in that conversation. He went back to the US carriers and said, no, you better start partnering up with them. So they know that he can be manipulated. They know that he can kind of sway one way or the other. And therefore, I think this is just Scott Kirby taking his chance. I'm interested to know, mind you. Yeah, okay. I was going to say, I'm interested to know exactly when in February this happened, because most of February were those build-ups of, is Trump about to strike Iran? Is Trump about to start the war? Is it going to be this weekend? Is it going to be next weekend? And I would love to know the date, because in the middle of all that, was he really waving around a paper in front of the president about merging United and American, and why he decided to pursue a new war?
Well, the interesting context here is that, of course, there's been all this buzz since last year that United would potentially want to purchase JetBlue, because JetBlue has been struggling financially. United is desperate to get back into JFK, where JetBlue obviously has a big presence. So the potential layers here are that United might be throwing this out in the air to then make a JetBlue merger seem much less hurtful to the industry and much more of an easy ask compared to asking for an American merger. The interesting part of Americans' response to United's going out about wanting to merge with American was that American also said they believe there need to be mergers and sort of hinted that they might also try to buy JetBlue. Obviously, American is in a much more vulnerable position financially than United is.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating how there's all these layers to what's going on in the industry right now. And I think JetBlue is the best airline in the U.S., so I think it would be horrible if either United or American bought them, but that's the way the U.S. industry goes. We have consolidation, and this will be very interesting to follow what happens, because I think that the JetBlue merger is very much on the cards right now with the soaring fuel costs, with JetBlue.
Agreed.
I mean, their financial outlook for this year does not look very good. So we will see what happens, but will there be an American and United merger? That seems extremely unlikely.
It's funny, that the way that the UK is obsessed with the idea of holiday rather than just air travel, which we've spoken about extensively. Just now, it's just flashed up on my screen. The EU Energy Commissioner was asked by Sky News about the situation, and he replied, quote, "Unfortunately, it is very likely that many people's holidays will be affected either by flight cancellations or very, very, very expensive tickets." Mm-hmm. He says, "Even if we do everything we can, if the jet fuel is not there, then it's not there." And now this jet fuel conversation is really taking hold. Interestingly, a month ago when I started speaking about this, people were messaging, "Oh, there's still fuel today. It's not." But genuinely, like, this Strait of Hormuz has to open because the situation is dire. And it's not just the price of it that's driving up those fares. It's the lack of it in the first place. If there is no supply, those airline schedules are going to continue to shrink.
Correct.
Just a little
side note
that just flashed up.
You were a whistleblower when it came to this.
Well, I didn't want to be, but I knew what was ahead, and but that's what happens when you know something that is ahead, and you kind of stick your head up and say this is what's coming, and it's based on fact and reality. But that situation hasn't yet presented itself to the wider public. There is, in the beginning, scrutiny. BBC Radio 4 invited me on to talk about it, and they said, what's the? And I said, over the coming weeks, particularly late April, the situation could move from severe to critical as we move into May and so on. And the presenter on BBC Radio 4 said to me, "I just want to ask you something." I said, "I'm just going to read you a statement here from Airlines UK, an association of the UK airlines, blah, blah, blah." And he said, "The Airlines UK response to this is, quote, Airlines UK can confirm that there is currently no jet fuel shortage." He said, I thought I'd just put that to you, Alex, for your reaction. And I said, "Yeah, the key word in that sentence is currently." He was like, I was like, "Currently is doing a lot of heavy lifting. It's late March, buddy." Anyway, let's move to
Air New
Zealand.
Yeah,
this is fun. Bunk beds are here, everyone. So it might cost a fortune to fly. And if you can get the jet fuel, then bunk beds are almost here. They're going on sale from the 18th of May. It's the Sky Nest, which is that bunk bed concept. We're serious, by the way. We've spoken about this in a former episode. Go and find it. It was first unveiled in 2020, 6 years ago, has been delayed repeatedly, first by the pandemic, then by aircraft supply chain issues, 787 delivery delays. It is finally happening. Air New Zealand will put 6 individual lie-flat bunks. These are very much like cabin crew rest bunks, if you've ever seen them. Google image it. And basically, between economy and premium economy on the 787-9, there will be these bunks that are available to book. You can sleep 4 hours at a time. Each nest, as they're calling it, nest, that's cute, is 203 centimeters long, or if you're an American, 80 inches, and then 64 centimeters wide, I don't know what that is in inches across, at the shoulder, full length for most adults. Most adults. Dan, does 203 cm, 80 inches, are you able to lie down in a pod of that size?
Just barely. This is about the length of many seats. So my concern is more the width, because a normal single bed is 90 centimeters wide. This is 64. So it's basically two thirds of a normal bed, which if you look at the seat map, basically they're replacing six economy class seats with six bunk beds. So a space where there would be three seats widthwise and two rows are being taken out, which if you think about it, three economy class seats is not especially wide to then put two bunk beds and an entry and exit area.
And a ladder and a curtain and whatnot.
Yeah. And what's interesting here is I love, firstly, let's just say Air New Zealand is the airline of the people. The way they innovate in economy is so incredible to see because, I mean, New Zealand is far away. So if there's anywhere that, you know, needs innovation in economy, this is it. They revolutionized economy with the Sky Couch, which now we're seeing United license from Air New Zealand, actually, where you can create a bed from a row of three. Now they're upping the game again with this addition. So there will be the Sky Couch and the Sky Nest. The thing that I struggle with is the price, because as you said, you get a 4-hour block and you cannot book more than 4 hours, so you couldn't do eight if you wanted to.
Yeah,
but per 4 hours it's $300, which is very steep in my opinion.
$300 US, right?
Yes, $300 US, about 500 New Zealand for an upgrade from economy, essentially, because it would be one thing if this is in business, but I think that in general, obviously, economy passengers are more price sensitive. If they wanted more comfort, they might have already bought into premium economy, for example. But a $300 for 4 hours of something seems a bit ambitious, but we will see. What do you think about
I agree with everything that you said, and also it's funny, the amenity kit is going to be called, it's branded Nestcessities, because this is a Sky Nest, so the Nestcessities will include an eye mask, socks, earplugs, dental kit. So they had a bit of an event for this, didn't they, to show it off, and people were able to experience the mock-up for the first time. When I was looking at videos, firstly, I would not want to be in that lower bunk, because that's like on the floor. Almost, it basically is, and you really you have to crawl to get into it, which is a bit claustrophobic. Then you have, it's funny, you really have to ensure that the passengers have the correct decorum to do this, because you're essentially introducing the idea of a cabin crew bunk, but for the public who have never engaged with anything like this in the confines of an aircraft cabin, right? So there are rules. So it's 1 4-hour session per passenger, as you said. The sessions are planned outside of the meal service and they can't be booked for takeoff or landing. They are available as an add-on to any economy or premium economy passenger, not as a standalone booking. Minimum age is 15. Passengers under 15 can't use it under any circumstances. If you're traveling with a child under 12, that child must be accompanied in the cabin by someone else who is 15 or older, meaning a solo adult traveling with a young child can't use the Skynest. The upper bunks require physical ability to climb the step ladder. Passengers with reduced mobility obviously will find it difficult to access any of those bunks. Initially, it's only going to be on select ultra long haul flights between New York and Auckland on the Dash 9, and only two aircraft will be fitted with this at first, so that they can kind of determine how it goes. One Skynest per one person, and nobody else in with you.
Good to mention.
Not just that, I mean, the proximity to your neighbor, above, next to you, it's like, if someone's a snorer, you've had it, right? But also, I was thinking, oh God, if someone was coughing or sneezing or sets their alarm, or, you know, admittedly, all of these things are a concern in ordinary economy. But there is something that changes your expectation when you know you're in a place that you're now lying down, ready for bed, you know, to sleep.
And in some ways, this is more private. It actually is more private than Air New Zealand's business class, because you have a wall around you with a curtain you can close. So it feels the concept feels very inviting. But as you say, in the space where there would be six economy seats, there will now be six adults laying flat, trying to sleep at the same time on top of each other, basically. Which, yeah, I am fascinated to see how this starts.
It's a real social experiment. I wish that there would be passengers that would consent to having like a reality show filmed for how they get on with these like cameras that are seeing who's going to get the most. They should issue each passenger with a whoop, right? Not an aura ring, because you've got that, but a whoop. And then and then they can accurately see who got some REM, who entered deep sleep state, who was awake for most of it. I also think that passengers that do book this will realize, and we have to speak to someone if we don't try it ourselves. We have to speak to someone. Do you feel that novelty of, oh my God, they're ordinarily in an economy seat and now they're in some kind of weird bunk bed on a plane that has never existed before for passengers and blah, blah, blah. Don't you think that novelty is enough to keep someone awake for 4 hours?
Oh my God, that's so true, actually.
Like, they're going to lie down. I'm on a plane. I'm lying down and I'm on a plane. I'm on a bunk. There's a woman opposite me. There's a guy above me. This is insane. I'm the first passenger. There's Skynest. I've got to tell everyone about it. I should take some photos. It's narrow. And then it's like, TikTok, buddy, 2 hours left. Like, I feel like my brain would be so active. I would be exhausted by the time I left, and I'd fall into the deepest sleep in economy after.
Yeah, that could be the case. I think the fact that premium economy can buy into this as well indicates to me that we'll probably have more premium economy passengers going for this. Premium economy will have 52 seats, so it's a massive cabin. These are people who have already paid a huge premium for Air New Zealand Premium Economy, which, keep in mind, this is only available for now on New York to Auckland, Air New Zealand's longest flight, of like 17 hours or so. So tickets are already extremely expensive on that nonstop. So people paying Premium Economy, maybe they're at the price point where, okay, I'll invest in this. I can also see people investing in it to make content for social media, because I've seen a lot of people making content from the Sky Couch. I know.
Come with me as I take a 4 hour. Go away. Like,
that's gonna be me, Alex.
Oh my God.
I wish them the best, and I hope it works out and is even expanded, because offering people more choice to have various levels of comfort and to upgrade their journey in small ways, I think is always a good thing. And I'm excited to see what comes of this.
Agreed. Well, with that, let's move in and do a couple Q&A.
Let's do it.
I've got a question here from Zane. It's about Europe's border chaos. And he says that obviously the fuel crisis isn't the only thing that's making European travel really hard this summer. Are you guys concerned about the EU's new entry-exit system, which went fully live on April 10th and has immediately been a complete and utter mess? Zane, you're right. It has been a mess. And I am speaking to different airport CEOs actually across Europe to get their thoughts on this, because Greece has emerged as a bit of an outlier here. They have declared that they will simply not be doing this for British travellers, because they get so many British arrivals to Greece, the Greek islands and so on. It's taking such time. I witnessed this firsthand at a few airports over the last few weeks. It was a joke how long it was taking. The camera was malfunctioning. People were confused. The immigration officers are behind glass and they're going, stand back. And they're not easily understood. And you've got passengers who don't speak their language saying, huh, what? You? I've given you my passport. And it was taking, where the EU said it's going to take 30 seconds per passenger. No, I was witnessing 6 to 7 minutes at best per passenger. And it was awful. So I don't know how this is going to play out, or if they're actually going to continue to commit to this. But we may see some moves in line with what Greece has done, where they're trying to limit this, especially that they're introducing it ahead of summer. Whose bright idea was that? I know this has been delayed. And originally it was going to start however many years ago, at the end of summer. But just to make sure that summer travel is even worse, they're doing this now. I'm against it, basically.
And let's not forget to add that e-gates for EU citizens in Europe 50% of the time, wherever you are, they're closed for some reason and don't work. And
yeah, because of beautiful European efficiency.
Exactly. I flew from Copenhagen a few days ago, non-Schengen. And then it was like a circus. There were hundreds of people in line. No one could figure out, because the e-gates were closed, of course. No one can figure out which line should I be in as EU versus non-EU. So there was a bunch of back and forth. And what ended up happening is that as flights were closing, so someone would go, anyone flying to Manchester? And then like 100 people from the line would exit the line and be brought to the front. And then anyone flying to Boston? Mess. And then the same exact thing.
That's not sustainable.
No. And then on my flight, you know, the same thing happens when we're just in front. And then suddenly everyone else who's behind in line comes up to the front as well. God. So like we wouldn't have had to stand in line so long. But yeah, it's literally like you're just creating this. There's no point in standing in line until they call your flight, first of all, because you're going to be brought to the front sooner than you're going to get to the front. But I don't know what, especially with the e-gates being down all the time in some places, what are they thinking? And by the way, Sweden does not even have e-gates yet at any airport. So
is that because IKEA haven't introduced them into the catalog yet? That Strait of Hormuz closure just keeps on hitting. It's just the gift that keeps on giving, isn't it? I mean, passengers around Europe have been waiting for 3 hours or so at the border. Then the European Union are telling passengers, start expecting this. What a joke. Understandably, the industry is on our side. ACI Europe, they deal with airports, Airlines for Europe, and Association of European Airports, issuing a joint statement calling the disruption not simply a teething issue, but a systematic failure, demanding that the European Commission immediately introduce some form of flexibility or something. EasyJet, massively affected by this, by all the Brits standing in line in Spain, calling the border delays unacceptable and urging the authorities to make full use of permitted flexibilities for as long as needed. It's a mess. I think they should hard launch this when it's not the beginning of summer travel. Just an idea. But I'm just seeing now, Airlines for Europe proposed fix is to allow for the full suspension of this through the end of summer, wherever wait times become excessive, and to just ensure that they pick this up again in the winter. The Commission has so far resisted the European Commission.
Okay, one final question, wish here from Ella. She says, hi, Dan and Alex, please come to the new Frankfurt Terminal Terminal 3. We want to hear you say something nice about Frankfurt Airport.
Do we have to?
No, we should go. I want to see it, okay? And it has potential, right? To up the game at Frankfurt Airport, and all airlines besides Lufthansa and their Star Alliance partners will be using it. So it is big news to people who have had to fly through the previous non-Lufthansa terminal there.
Chris wrote in on Sunday.
Have any comment.
All right, we'll go. What do you want me to say? All right. You want us to go, right? This is your request.
Yes.
Is that? Am I right? That's what you want?
I want us to go. Yes, I agree with Ellis.
Okay, I said okay then. All right, we'll sort it. I mean, there's a few more pressing issues to deal with right now, but we'll... Okay, Chris wrote in to blame us entirely for the fact that he got A10 the other day at Terminal 5. He says, I am blaming you with the Heathrow gates. Usually it's completely fine, but today it's A10 in Terminal 5 and I have not slept. This is entirely Dan and yours fault. Thank you for writing in, Chris. And then this one was interesting. This is from somebody who refers to himself as La Womble, who says, hi, Dan and Alex. I've been a huge fan of Dan's YouTube channel for years and I've only just recently discovered the podcast, which says to me that you're not nearly promoting it enough on your own channels where you have millions and millions of viewers. So you need to up your game there, buddy. La Womble says, I'm a third year law student and I'm going back and catching up listening to all of the old episodes while studying, using them as motivation to keep me working hard so I can do lots more traveling in the future. How lovely is that? They say, the reason I'm writing is that I'm just listening to season 1, episode 28. God knows what that's about.
Yeah.
And a Q&A episode from 2 years ago. And Alex, if you haven't read The Art of Racing in the Rain, you have to. Anyone who loves dogs and motorsports, specifically Senna, Ayrton Senna, the F1 driver, must read this book. Anyway, that's what I wanted to write. Love that you're both also animal lovers. Dan, if you ever need a lawyer for your animal sanctuary, count me in. Thanks for the podcast.
Oh, wow.
Just really sweet, sweet messages that I notice in the requests of my own account, but I don't see those that come into the On Air with Dan and Alex account because Dan's got the keys.
I've blocked you.
Hasn't yet sent me the login. It's one of those things you keep not getting around to, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I've been busy for the past year and a half.
Yeah. Okay. Well, on that note, I say that we regroup same time, same place next week. And guys, remember, if you enjoyed this episode or any others, feel free to share it with those who are in your circles, your aviation circles, your group chats and whatnot. But also, if you do listen, for example, on Spotify or Apple, and you leave us 5 stars, we will soon be resuming, assuming the global economy recovers a bit, we can start resuming international shipping of some amenity kits that we recently got our hands
nice.
On and we'd like to run as a competition. So if you can leave us a review and then maybe screenshot that review that you've left with the star rating and your comments and send it as a screenshot to the shared Instagram at On Air with Dan and Alex, one word. We will include you on the Excel spreadsheet that I'm going to demand Dan starts mapping out.
All right. Thank you, boss. Okay.
No worries.
Well, thank you for tuning in today, guys. Well said, Alex. And we will see you next week on air. Bye-bye.
See you later. Bye-bye.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.
All medications require eligibility and prescription. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.